Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Venture with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Ollie Harris. Ollie is an entrepreneur turned venture capitalist with a knack for spotting winning bets, quite literally. Ollie is partner at Dream Ventures, a dynamic US-based fund spun out from a Las Vegas single family office. Dream Ventures brings a gambler's instinct to investing, targeting elite technology and consumer companies from late seed to Series A. He founded The Sporting Blog, scaling it to over 3 million readers, and co-founded Championship Horse Racing's groundbreaking racing league, collaborating with giants like Sky Sports, News UK, eToro, and William Hill. In today's episode, we talk about what parallels can be drawn between the poker table and a VC.
One thing that people often talk about in venture is, you know, where's your edge? Where's your point of difference and all that stuff? I think that we come from a really interesting vertical like that.
How can founders make the transition to becoming a proper CEO?
Genuine turned CEOs struggle with the people day to day to turn into that, to be able to, as you say, delegate. For me, that adaptability is crucial.
And how Dream takes a pragmatic approach to managing other people's money.
Investor is one part of your job, of course, but fundamentally you're a money manager for other people's...
Fiduciary, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's lost on people a bit.
How to be a great fiduciary, thinking about your portfolio in thirds and building trust with founders and with LPs.
LPs to have trust in managers, you know, if you can give them some DPI, I think it's a very good sign of trust and what your intentions are.
How bigger funds means bigger bets and fundamental changes in how you approach your investment strategy, and whether or not you can codify what makes a great founder. And realistically, should you even try?
Why do you want to codify a human being? We're not trying to rush through understanding whether a founder ticks all these notional boxes.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a second, I thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you enjoy the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could like, subscribe, and rate wherever it is you listen. And of course, if you want to talk to me about anything that we've discussed on the podcast or even want to recommend a guest, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or X. I'm always up for a chat. Right, let's get going. Ollie, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you for joining me. Really excited to be doing this.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great to take a trip down memory lane and come to this part of London as well.
Yeah, we were talking about that a bit earlier. Yeah. We might have to kind of delve into the sort of Northwest London background. But Listen, you've got legendary poker players like Phil Hellmuth and Daniel Negreanu as LPs in Dream. So how does that kind of high stakes poker mindset influence the way you make investment decisions at Dream? And how would you describe the parallels between sitting at a poker table and investing in startups?
I wouldn't go so far as to say like how it influences our investing style, but what it gives us is access to a different world. I think that one thing that people often talk about in venture is, you know, where's your edge, where's your point of difference and all that stuff. I think that we come from a really interesting vertical like that. I mean, people like this also do a lot of different things. So yeah, it may be that, you know, they make their money playing cards as their primary pursuit, but that allows them, it's not only high stakes poker that they're doing all day and night, right? It's celebrity stuff, it's ambassadorial stuff, it's representing brands, you know, much like any athlete, I suppose. Mm. But at the same time, in this very cerebral yet raw and gritty world. So I think what we get from mixing with those people is a slightly different attitude towards success and failure. Mm. You can't win every hand of cards, but you know, with the right patterns, the right amount of practice and years of experience, you can certainly come out the right side. Mm. And I think someone like Hellmuth in particular, who I think he's the most winningest, as they call it in the States, poker player in history, the most bracelets and all of that. I mean, You're talking about someone whose nickname was the Brat, Poker Brat, and has been playing since he was a kid, and I think he's now in his late 50s. You know, that's a lot of time spent with other people. Mm. That's a lot of time sitting around card tables.
Understanding individuals, right?
Absolutely, but yeah. And it's not always just to like, you know, sitting around poker tables analyzing people's behavior to win the money. It's like genuinely mixing with so many humans over the course of 30, 40 years. I mean, that adds up to a huge amount of experience. It's a very transient industry. They're playing tournaments all over the world. It's not just in like smoky rooms in Vegas anymore. And they're celebrities in their own right. But what you get is kind of the ultimate networker, I'd say. And I think that's probably one of our USPs.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'd probably take it a step further as well, right? So yes, networking, I think really understanding humans, right? Being able to spot certain traits, certain characteristics within individuals, right? Yes, because there is still an element of analysis, right? When you're sitting at a poker table, not that I am either a poker player or if I were a very good poker player, I don't think I have the ability to hold a poker face. But that gives you kind of an insight into risk attitudes amongst individuals. And then I guess to an extent, when you're working with founders, you want to find that balance of an individual that is both willing to take risk, but calculated risk, right?
And an analytical mind too. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think with startup founders, like, of course, every person that works in venture will say that they found the most amazing founder and they've got the grit and the resilience and the determination. And I think the one we look for is adaptability, adaptability in situations too, because startup founders end up becoming CEOs. And if their company's doing well, they then have to manage people. And that's a big different thing from the very beginning. So that adaptability comes from understanding people, understanding motivation, and that sort of thing. And I do believe that people that play games for a living, including like athletes, one of their biggest strengths is adaptability. That's not just changing playing technique or style, but that's moving country, living out of a suitcase. Like that adaptability is quite hard to teach, but you tend to learn it. Of course, there are the cases, rare cases of founders that just have it all from day one. But I think those people are pretty rare. So, you know, when we're talking to a founder, we put a high premium on the relationship with the founder. We either fly them out to Vegas or we fly to meet them or we spend a lot of time with them. And the thing is, can we see this person transitioning from either a very technical founder or maybe they're just an out there person that's just good at building stuff to actually being able to run a business with hundreds of staff and all the politics that goes along with it. And as they slowly get taken away from the bit they find probably the most rewarding. And I think that all, you know, that comes back to the thing about people that play high stakes cards for a living, like it's adaptability, a different place, different times, long times at the table, short time at the table. And I think that goes for sports men and women as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. Actually, you say that like a couple of like, so I remember one VC friend of mine, we're talking about one of their portfolio founders. And you know, what he said to me was he's been really good at building revenue, but he hasn't been great at building a business. And when I thought about what he was saying, it was quite an early stage business. I completely understood what he meant, right? Like
totally.
It's one thing to, and of course we all know that selling is massively important, right? Let's not get that wrong, but building systems, building repeatable processes, building a team around you, all of this stuff is super critical. I myself, and we were talking about, you know, my yet to be finished book earlier, but like one of the chapters is, you know, great founders don't necessarily make great CEOs. And the point there is exactly that, right? Like as a founder, you are absolutely driven by the problem, the pain point that you're trying to solve, the product, whatever it might be. But when it then comes to building the business around you, building a team, giving up control, like the crisis of control, right?
Yeah.
How do you cope with that and shift from being the person doing everything to the person directing everyone else to do the things that need to be done? And that isn't an easy transition. I personally know my own traits, right? At the ripe old age of whatever I am at the moment, that I'm not a great manager of people. It's not something that I enjoy doing. It's not something that I'm
well, that's also good at. That's also the thing is the enjoyment aspect.
Yeah.
You know, I would consider, and this is not a boastful thing, I would consider myself quite a good leader, but not a very good manager of people.
Same. Yeah.
So I can set an example. I can coordinate quite well from afar. I can certainly put plans in place, But, you know, the actual day-to-day management of lots of people, I think that's a real skill that not all of us have. And there's plenty of founders turned genuine CEOs, if you know what I mean. Of course, they all start with a badge CEO, but genuine turned CEOs struggle with the people day-to-day. So-and-so's got a problem, so-and-so can't make it in. Someone's said this to him or her. And I think that people who've got who are wired a particular way find that stuff irritating as well. Or it's a problem that I really haven't got time for sort of thing. Because the bigger problem is the one I've been trying to solve since day one. So to move into that, to turn into that, to be able to, as you say, delegate, for me, that adaptability is crucial. And that's not to say that introverted types or people that are ultra technical can't do it. And of course they'll find people to employ to help them with that aspect. But ultimately, as a CEO, you're responsible for everyone in the business. At some point. You will be ultimately responsible. And there are, you know, some people are better at it than others.
And it's very much a matter of temperament. It's of course. You know, we've seen, you know, there are numerous, you know, stories in the press around big name ventures where the founder ultimately was just not the right person as CEO. And we've seen lots of changes happen in various businesses. And I think, look, the way I look at it is if a founder, or if anyone for that matter, it doesn't need to be the founder, it could be the investor, et cetera, right? But are you self-aware enough to know that this is what I'm good at, this is what I'm not good at? And I think one of the fallacies, not just in startup world, but in sort of in general, is that you should try and fix your deficiencies. I actually think no, lean into your strengths. find the people that complement you to build on those areas where you.
It's kind of interesting that I've actually got a friend who's an exited founder who's started a business called Strengthify, which is coaching based on this principle of strengths, and.
Gallup has sort of strengths finders, which they've had out for many years, which is really good.
But if you think of this whole thing, it's an atypical situation, I mean, which most stuff in venture is. But just because you've founded a company, let's just fast forward 4 years, you've done pretty well, and maybe you've gone from two people to 60 or 70 or whatever. It's very unusual if you were just in a normal job that you would suddenly be propelled to managing a team of 60 or 70 in that speed, that period of time. Like, that wouldn't necessarily be a standard thing. So it's so unusual. And because you're learning on the job at the same time, and if you're scaling fast, all of this stuff's happening around you. Right. So,
and often all in one shot, right? Like, in the sense that you raise a series A
and now it's time to do
your team grows by
50%. Well, and that's the expectation, because that's what you need the money for.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, if you think about that logically, that's also fairly bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, right. Okay. We now need to employ X people, which means we need an HR person all of a sudden. And I'm going to have to do it all at once because I need to keep like that. That in itself is. That actually makes me feel kind of sick, because like we've done that once before, and actually that was way more stressful than anything else, because you then start thinking, well, and because you're on the clock with your investors at that point, you start thinking, Christ, I've really got to do this well. And, you know, that suddenly again takes your attention right away from where you think it should be. So yeah, I mean, like, adaptability, I think it's the number one trait in founders.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And often the conversation I have with investors when we're working with founders is, you know, are these guys coachable? Are they adaptable, exactly as you say? Do they understand when to pivot, how to pivot, why to pivot? And that doesn't necessarily just mean product. That means, you know, in their style, in their cadence. And I think, you know, we had a great conversation with Fred Destin on the podcast like last year. And he was talking about it from the perspective of board members and investors as board members. And equally, they're understanding where your strengths, where should you lean in, when should you stay quiet, right? I think with founders, you know, what we tend to find is the best founders and managers of people are often the ones that will listen to the room, go out, digest, and then come back with their own thought, which may or may not be what the rest of the room has told them, right? But they've at least internalized and digested what it is that's been suggested. And some of the worst founders that we've ever worked with are the ones that, you know, pay lip service to that, right? Say, yeah, I'm listening, but go off and do whatever they want to do irrespective, right? And I think if we think about startups, you know, startups are all about adaptability because you are constantly changing, right? In your early stages, you are constantly pivoting. You're trying to find product market fit. As you start scaling, you know, you have other problems. You've got to deal with customers in a different way. You no longer have evangelists necessarily as your first customers. So you've got to start thinking about how do you deal with kind of more vanilla, crossing the chasm type customers. And then you're at scale and you've got hundreds of people in your team. You've got to think about managing, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so, no, look, I'd completely agree with your perspective there. I want to kind of talk about Dream for a second, because you guys take pride in being almost the anti-VC, right? So you don't chase unicorns. You chase solid businesses with fast returns, which I think, you know, in the current environment is probably going to become more and more pervasive amongst kind of the investor landscape. But what's fundamentally broken with traditional venture models, and why do you think your anti-VC approach kind of resonates with LPs and investors?
Well, this anti-VC thing certainly came about internally. So I don't think we're out there saying that we're like completely the sort of anti-Christ of venture. But I mean, I think what it is a more pragmatic approach to managing other people's money. Mm. I was on a call yesterday with some people, and something that came up was, you know, pointing out that VC's investor is one part of your job, of course, but fundamentally you're a money manager for other people's
fiduciary. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's lost on people a bit. Mm. And that might be because they're on a quest to solve a problem in a sector, or, you know, there, and that's okay to be passionately driven by. So I don't have a problem with that. But I think that our principle of looking at the portfolio in the round, this isn't like a contradiction of the power law or anything like that, because I think we all know that one or two companies are going to return the big money or not, as in most of the case, this is in point. But if we look to break down a portfolio roughly into thirds, and think of the first third as companies we've either known for a while, or there's a clear exit path soon. Mm. Okay, we might get out for a smallish multiple, but what it does allow us to do is then think of the DPI.
Mm. Which has been lacking, let's face
it. Well, yeah, because in a lot of interior. I mean, this is what the game's all about at the end of the day. And for LPs to have trust in managers, you know, if you can give them some DPI, I think it's a very good sign of trust and what your intentions are.
And that's distribution to paid in, for those that don't
know. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's basically giving money back to the investors, which, you know, is the ultimate goal of this thing. Yeah. The middle third of our portfolio probably are the companies that might never reach the unicorn status, but perhaps they're in a sector, maybe like a consumer type sector, where there are three or four specific buyers that tend to come in at a certain size or a certain point in the company's development. Mm. So, you know, I'm not saying those companies can't get bigger. Not saying that we're always pushing them that you've got to take an exit or anything like that. It's not about that. It's just about understanding where they fit in relation to the others in the portfolio, which is kind of that mid-tier bit. And again, if it's a 5x or a 6x or 7x return, that's probably okay for us, you know, depending.
And I think that middle layer, that middle third, as you say, again, I think that, you know, I think a lot of founders are now looking at building businesses with that in mind, right? Especially as the cost of capital has dropped, increased a little bit, but the cost of development has certainly dropped.
But there, I think it also, you know, let's look at consumer, which we like consumer because no matter the changes and advances in tech, people always need to eat and drink and wear stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So we kind of like consumer. It might not always be, not every consumer company is venture backable. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But those that are, you know, they're constricted in their growth with regards to location, distribution, branding, and all the rest of it. At some point, if they're going to keep growing, they've got to change something dramatically. That might mean if they're a company from the US and they really want to go to the unicorn style valuations, they're going to have to think about distribution into other parts of the world. They may just not be up for it.
Yeah.
Or they may just not be, or it might not be possible. Mm. So, you know, and those therefore might reach a size that's almost like, right, they're going to be acquired by a Unilever or P&G or Coke or someone that can
take or that distribution.
To do. Yeah. And so that it's more about the constraints, or maybe they've just reached saturation point in their vertical. And then the final third is our, is what, you know, the ones we hope, like every venture person hopes, goes to the moon. Mm. But, you know, I wouldn't say we're sitting there all day like plotting the thing, but I think what we know is we've got some intel on a company, or we've followed them for a while. Mm. Maybe we've invested into them from the family office and brought it into the fund.
Yeah.
And they're at a point where they may get for an exit. Like, that's okay with us. Mm. Like, that's all right.
You don't mind a secondary exit at an earlier
I think
stage.
It's again, it's about being pragmatic with it.
Yeah.
Like our investors are coming along for the ride with us on the basis that in the family office and as individuals, we've built successful companies and diverse companies. And therefore we can relate to founders in such a way that, look, if it's time for you to sell this thing, and maybe it's only a 2x for us on a smaller check, all right, there's no drama.
But equally, I mean, the other point there is that, you know, everyone chases the multiples or the valuation, depending on how you look at it, right? But in a world where private companies are staying private longer, larger multiples further down the track may actually be poorer returns than smaller multiples earlier,
sure,
right? Because from an IRR perspective, from a
correct,
from a time value of money perspective, cash in my hand today is better than a bit more cash down the track.
You know, ask our LPs how, if they want their money back.
Yeah.
If they want to get to net zero fast and then let the thing ride, they would all say yes.
Yeah.
Because then they've got their investment back.
They've
so
their
IRR
back and,
is even greater because they can do something else with that money.
They can recycle, right?
Yeah. So that's important for us too. And that has been our principle. And one of the things I really liked when I was talking to the guys who I've known for a long time, but about coming over to Dream full time, was our primary goal is to get investors their money back as fast as possible. Mm. And I was just like, well, that's refreshing, rather than the first thing is, you know, we're going to chase the, you know.
I think a lot of this also comes down to kind of the perception of what venture is, right? And I always go back to this because, you know, when I first got into the ecosystem 10 years ago, whenever it was, you know, I had very sort of starry-eyed, dreamy kind of like, oh, venture's about, you know, chasing innovation and chasing moonshots. What I realized was that innovation tends to be a secondary function of venture, right? Because the primary function of venture is to make money, right? Either as a GP because you're taking fees and then obviously carry, as an LP because you want to get a return on your capital. Now, obviously, what happens is because those businesses that are likely to return substantial amounts of capital are the ones that, you know, are probably moonshots, right? Or have something incredibly innovative happening in them. You know, you therefore get that outcome. But when you actually just fundamentally look at it, the business of venture is a business, right? So it is about returning capital to your LPs and making sufficient money that you can go and raise another fund so that you can do the whole thing again. Now, that sounds really depressing for sure. But I think when you look at it from that framework, actually, if you're successful in doing that well and not chasing the medium, right? So the other problem is you get the reports of, you know, the median returns are 1.8x or whatever. That's problematic because in venture, you shouldn't be thinking about things in terms of averages and medians, right? Because it is an outliers game.
Yeah.
So if you can construct a portfolio that returns exactly, say, your capital early, gets, you know, boosts the IRR because they're able to recycle that capital, et cetera, but still leaves room for those,
of course,
you know, for those outliers, then arguably that's a much better, that's a much better approach than simply chasing unicorns all the way, right?
Well, I think this may be, I'm not saying that the way we look at it is the way that venture is going to go, but, you know, whether I was at Super Venture and Super Return in Berlin last week, and apart from a lot of chat around secondaries, the idea of venture changing to kind of understand that the super outliers really are outliers, and that maybe this liquidity piece needs to be, you know, prioritized a bit more. And, you know, secondaries in Europe are very different to secondaries in the US, but, you know, so people talking about kind of private equity style secondaries to, you know, to allow us to give some liquidity back to investors and so on. You know, it's coming. Change in some way is coming. I think it always has done. I'm sure venture's the same as when it, you know, first started either. But it feels to me that there's a fundamental shift in attitude. But of course, still fundamentally, you know, we're hoping that companies go gangbusters. And that's the same for all of our companies, by the way. But sometimes we know that there are some that are going to be.
And you can potentially shepherd them then. If you spot early enough that, okay, this is not likely to be the 100 bagger or whatever, right? Well, okay, but there is an opportunity to sell at a decent multiple and have that conversation with the founders, you know, see if they're on the same pathway. Of course, you can't, you know, a lot of founders want to either go big or go home. Fine. But, you know, we've had Hannah Mason from Amply Ventures on the podcast before, you know, Swedish based firm. Her approach is very much, you know, we're backing SaaS businesses and founders where we want all of them to succeed. And success doesn't necessarily mean the $1 billion outcome. It means, okay, a good outcome. In fact, you know, speaking to a founder, or exchanging emails certainly with a founder that I've, you know, been in touch with the last couple of years, you know, hasn't taken capital since the early 2020s. Has just been busy building the business. They're now doing like a decent, you know, bottom line. There is almost certainly an exit opportunity for that business. It'll probably return some decent capital.
Probably
to investors.
A very happy person.
And he will almost certainly be a very happy person, right? Like, and you know, I always, it's like one of the fundamental questions that I ask of any founder is, do you understand what it means to take venture and what the expectations are going to be on you? And if you can get to a place where you've built your business and you own 80, 90, 100% and you exit for 10, 20 million, is that not potentially more interesting than backing the farm, betting the farm rather than...
The other thing is, and occasionally I think working in this sort of sector or industry, whatever you want to call it, can put you into a really different place to the rest of the world. Because... you know, even what you've just said, for 99% of the population is a ridiculous, you know, why are we even thinking like, oh, is that a good enough? Of course it is. People have been founding companies for as long as humans have been around. And, you know, the idea of cashing one in and becoming wealthy is great. Now, there are people that want to have much more wealth than others, of course, and it's a capital game. But I think sometimes we're a little bit guilty of focusing on the idea of fund returns and all of this and forgetting the human involved. You know, most people, I think, in normal life would be very happy to build a business over a decade and sell it and not necessarily need to have financial stress anymore. I mean, that's pretty much most people's happiness point, right?
I mean, it's definitely my... it's kind of my approach.
Exactly, but of course, what we can never forget, and you know, I've been there as the founder too several times, is that most of these things don't work. You know, the majority of them don't work. So, you know, the risk element and the return element is what it's all about, because, you know, write the check, whatever, how many companies are in the portfolio, most of them aren't going to work.
Yeah,
and that's a sobering thought at every turn. So, you know, often I think people, you know, the carrot is what keeps the motivation going, and the attrition rate is the, you know, that's the cost of doing business.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know, I think sometimes it can sit uncomfortably with me, the way that we sort of commoditize people and the businesses as units in a portfolio, which they are.
Yeah.
But, you know,
but there is a human behind it.
There is. And of course, if every company of our portfolio took an early exit, we probably wouldn't be able to return every dollar to investors. So we understand the thing. But at the same time, broadly speaking, I think we understand the journey that people are going through as well. And that is like a solid dose of realism every now and then. And I think in a small fund or a small firm, you can still be like that. I have no idea what it's like when you get to like A16 and insight levels.
Yeah.
What any of that stuff means anymore.
I'm not sure they know.
No, probably not. I mean, asset managers, you know, for real all of a sudden, you know, and but yeah, that's for a story for another day, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, so you talked about it just now, but just to expand on this point around the velocity of money, right? The velocity of returns to LPs, et cetera. How does that change your relationship with the LPs? So presumably they're not sort of sitting there from day one pounding their fists, return our cash or whatever. But, you know, do they look at it as you said, like as a positive net positive that they're getting cash returned early? And does that then lead them to be more likely to kind of reinvest as LPs down the track? Or do they even say, let it ride or use this for follow on?
I think in our case, our LPs are a pretty close community.
Hmm.
They're people that inherently trust that we can build a really successful venture firm as one of the things that we do within the group of people, from family office to us as partners. Like, so that trust is like, okay, if you guys feel that returning that money early, like, of course it makes us feel good, yeah, to get a few percentage points back, great, because it shows that we're thinking about them. But I think that there's a real trust from our investors to this point that we know what we're doing. And if that's the strategy we're going to go for, then, you know, they're all for it. No one's turned around and said, hold on, you know, you should leave that in for reinvestment or anything like that. Now, again, I don't know if that's possible when you're on the fifth or the sixth fund. You know, who knows?
Actually, that whole question about kind of the fifth, sixth fund or whatever, even the second, third, right? If you think about it, you know, you guys invest at pre-seed, seed, presumably, for the most part.
The first fund was, the next one's a bit later.
Okay. But a larger fund size, by its very nature, means you have to shift towards, later stages. At later stages, returns tend to be slightly, not smaller, but as in multiples tend to compress, right? And there is this, there's this weird kind of middle valley, or I don't know how you describe it, where actually going over a certain fund size maybe stops you being able to invest in the things that you want to invest.
I think with regards to the funds, it's about then the size of the bets, of course. And I think if you feel pressured that you've got to bet bigger because you have to because of the return profile and the rest of it, I think that fundamentally changes sort of everything we do. I believe, however, we're sufficiently confident in the founders that we've backed from the early stages that we're likely to back them again. And we're likely to try and get to a good ownership percentage of the company ahead of any potential exit. So that, people call it conviction, they call it doubling down, whatever they want to call it. We're just like, unless something dramatic happens, I think we're normally very confident in our founder picking. So we're going to try and back them through, and that maybe that means across different funds at the later stages, et cetera, which is not uncommon.
Out of interest, because we talked about it earlier as well, this kind of, you know, you look for founders with adaptability, etc., right? But when you're picking founders, do you have a process, like do you have sort of a checklist of things that you're looking for, or does it tend to be every conversation?
Look, I was at an event in the Tech Arena in Stockholm in February, and as an LPGP lunch, and there was this sort of fairly small Indian guy in the corner, and he hadn't said anything really for the whole lunch, and he'd come in quite late. So people were like, okay, well, do you want to introduce yourself? Because we've already done that. And he said, oh, I'm so-and-so from a fund in India. I've been in the business for 30, 40 years, and we've had X exits and now we're IPOs. And everyone's like, okay, hold on, this guy's like a Yoda. And so everyone then was encapsulating, asking this guy questions, quiet, unassuming chap, really nice guy. And someone from a family office said to him, so, you know, have you managed to codify what makes a good founder? And he just sort of rubbed his brow and he's like, I don't know, why do you want to codify a human being? And he says, one thing that, you know, we're not trying to speed up that part of the process. We're trying to speed up filtering out, you know what I mean? We're filtering out opportunities, but we're not trying to rush through understanding whether a founder ticks all these notional boxes.
Because then you actually conversely limit your optionality, right?
But so, I mean, when I said earlier we fly them all to Vegas, it's not like we're putting founders on a plane and taking them out. But yeah. What it's about is, you know, should we hang with this person for 2 or 3 days to get under the skin? Because, and this is no fault of anyone's because it's human nature, but there might be pressures in life. There might be shiny object syndrome. There might be health stuff, whatever it is, that actually mean that not necessarily we can't invest in you, but are you really up for this journey? Especially if they've got some early traction already. And then, as you say, you're about to take the red pill or the blue pill. Which one are you going to do? And the question is, are you up for this? Because this is a long game now. And then you're going to have to talk to people like me for the next 5 years minimum.
Yeah.
Like, do you really want that?
We joke on the podcast. I mean, like, the average founder-investor relationship lasts longer than the average UK marriage, right?
I mean, it could do. But it's like, so rather than just saying, do they tick all the boxes? I mean, it's about us sort of generally getting a feeling like she's an absolute lunatic, like she's going to go for this, there's no doubt. Like, and I, most of the founders in our portfolio, when I joined, I went through them all, have this fairly
lunacy.
Yeah, there's an edge to most of them.
It's the chip on the shoulder, it's the whatever it is that drives.
There's something, but and personality, I think, shines through. There's very few kind of bedroom kind of coder guys that are not out there in some way. But that's just the sort of companies we back. We like people that understand how to build community and have an edge somewhere. But I don't think, and in the age of AI, everyone's trying to find a way to get to the decision bit faster. I don't necessarily think that's a win for a fund manager. Why are you trying to get to that? Maybe you're trying to get there faster because you want to make sure you get your allocation.
Yeah,
I kind of get that. But at the same time, if everyone's allocating to it already, well, maybe maybe you can trust that, or maybe you need your own signals. I don't know. But in our case, it really is about, as a human, as a team, are these people going to stick it out?
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, we need them to stick it out.
Yeah.
It's not just how big the dream is.
Can they
stick it out? Yeah. I mean, in my own case, in one of my previous companies, as co-founders, our alignment changed after 5 years and various stresses.
As it often does. Yeah.
Do you want to raise again?
Yeah.
Should we take more money? Should someone want to cash out off the table because I want to buy a house? I remember speaking to a founder about 2 years ago who built a phenomenal business. She had done super well, very big network, well followed online. And I remember her saying to me, like, I'm getting married soon and like, I just can't afford to buy a house. And you're like, well, this is insane. And I'm not saying it did with her, but it could easily change your motivation for doing things. So, and that's normal.
Yeah.
So, if we get to know someone.
I mean, apart from the fact that 5 years in or 7 years in, like, I don't think a lot of people understand how incredibly tough it is mentally, physically, emotionally to build even a small business, let alone
one where you've got other people breathing down your neck saying to you, are you on track?
Yeah.
Because it's like, hold on, I don't even know. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to be on track.
And actually, it's interesting. When I tried and failed to build a tech business myself, the thing that I realized out of it at a personal level was that element of being beholden, if I can put it that way, to, you know, investors and et cetera, all of whom were amazing and lovely people. Like, it's just not... I like building under my own steam. I like having control over what I'm going to do. And so I know for a fact I would be, even if I had a problem that was worth solving, and I also realized that I don't necessarily have that, but even if I had that problem worth solving, I don't have the staying power. Staying power is the wrong way of putting it. I get distracted by too many interesting things that I know that I'm not just going to be relentlessly focused on something for 10 years on the off chance that it may make.
Well, and you know, maybe that's an even greater risk in the AI age too, because, you know, I find most founders are by nature curious.
Yeah.
As in, you've got to have a certain amount of curiosity to want to go down this path. And, you know, when tech's moving at such a high speed and things can change overnight and all of a sudden there's an agent that can do something else, I mean, it's quite natural to have your head turn a bit and think, hold on, maybe what I'm building here is not going to be, you know. And
actually, even if it was, that could change on a dime because again, if things move quick, like, you know, the example being trotted out at the moment is Granola, the meeting transcript application is dead because OpenAI's released it natively. I don't think it's dead, and I think Granola is a great product. Shout out to Granola, but I'm not even an investor. I don't know why I'm shouting them out, but I really do like the product. But the point is, something else substantial could happen that makes that product less, less feasible or viable as a venture outcome potentially,
sure,
than it did a year ago or 6 months ago, right?
But the shiny object syndrome is real. Mm. I mean, it's real for most of us in all walks of life.
Mm.
But I think it's particularly dangerous in startup founders. And that shiny object could be all sorts of things. It could be the lure of come and set up over here instead of there because there's a tax advantage, or come and do that. And, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And absolutely, again, we all do that. I think that's human nature too. But, you know, can we figure out whether a person is susceptible to that or not, or whether they're, you know, people talk about, we need founders to be obsessed. I think all founders are obsessed, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it.
Mm.
But it's like, can you be obsessed with really your North Star and understand there's pivots because the things aren't working? But otherwise, sure, you know, I really believe that that's what it is.
So often when we go into businesses and we're supporting, like, you know, you can tell a lot from building out a financial model, for example, for a founder, because one of the things we say is, if you have more than one revenue stream and you're relatively early stage, you aren't focused on the right thing. You've got to nail the one thing first. And I'm definitely that, you know, it's hilarious I'm even saying this because I have lots of friends that would tell me, but Arish, you do not ever focus on the one thing. But if you don't nail the one thing.
But this is the venture thing again, exactly, right? Because in the normal world, like, people are like, okay, you've got a bit of diversity in your revenue, and that might become a very useful thing if one falls out of bed.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, in venture, it's not polarized. You know, you've got to be, you need to grow one.
Big and, in one and then figure out because, the others.
And that again, so, you know, I'm one of the, I look exactly for that too. And someone says, we've got this and this, and there's a consulting bit in there or something. Mm. You're like, oh, okay, this doesn't feel intuitively like a venture backable business.
Mm. Or it's, you know, or it's a founder hedging their bets. Well, the interesting thing is, it's often a founder either hedging their bets, but more often than not, their assumption is there are all these revenue streams, we can make it big. Well, and I'm like, yeah, but if you don't execute on one really well, there's no way you're going to execute on
four. The other one. But the reason most of them do it is for survival.
Yeah, sure. Also, yeah,
you know, I've got a consulting element, in, like, I'm still getting paid X a month under the guise of the business because it's roughly in that, because I need to pay myself.
Mm.
You know, again, human nature, you need to pay yourself.
Mm.
And I think, you know, someone that's doing a pre-seed or a very early round, and it's to build this stuff and all the rest of it, you know, and, you know, someone's still going to pay $3,000 or $4,000 a month for, you know, a bit of consultancy as part of it. I mean, you can't not, because you're, you know, you just can't.
Yeah.
So, but again, we would say, okay, that probably has to go because you're not focusing on the thing.
Yeah, it is incredible. And I think that there is this, like, huge dichotomy that, or, you know, this kind of inherent issue needs to be resolved, right? And this comes back to, like, I saw a post yesterday saying, we should normalize Series A founders taking some cash off the table. I actually don't think that's controversial at all.
No.
And I think, you know, if a founder has managed to get to Series A, which would suggest that they're showing signs of traction, signs of growth, et cetera, especially in today's world where graduation from seed to Series A is already, you know, depressed compared to a few years ago, then yeah, take a bit of cash off the table, pay your mortgage down, make sure your kids are settled, whatever the thing is, because surely that's going to, you know, you could look at it two ways. Oh, well, that's going to make them too comfortable.
No,
I don't think that's a problem at all.
Personally, right? I don't buy that for a minute. Yeah. I just don't. I think you wipe away people's stress.
Yeah.
Take away the main source of stress in your life,
and
whatever it might be.
And then laser focus on everything
else. You can get up in the morning and you've got a sense of freedom. And it's like, right, I can actually just work on this thing now.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I don't have to worry about anyone knocking on my door ever again.
Yeah.
Like, it's a no-brainer for me.
I really don't get those that don't get that. It either means they've never been in that position themselves, I think,
or they're wired in such a way that again you're commoditizing people, and that, you know, again, maybe that's okay for them. It wouldn't be for me. I think ever since I kind of got involved in secondaries a few years ago and speaking to secondary funds, I think this is one of the great, you know, potential uses. I mean, we don't do it enough in Europe.
Yeah.
We don't think about it enough, or founders don't think about it enough, or don't get the option. But for me, it's an absolute no-brainer.
Well, the problem is also, and this is a whole different podcast, but, you know, we talk to founders who have or are raising Series A's, and they're talking about it in terms of, you know, single digit millions. There simply isn't enough to then do a secondary, right? So the you know, because you like to do a meaningful secondary but also have enough capital in, you know, fresh capital into the business, doesn't make sense. Whereas if you're in the US and you're doing a 20 million Series A,
it's a different thing.
There's something you can do there. So one of the things, though, and you know, I think I've been hearing it throughout kind of the podcast in any case, but you've said that venture, or have you certainly mentioned, that venture is a weird, fragmented industry that is full of hype. So what is the most frustrating misconception people have about venture, and how do you navigate the noise to find real opportunities?
Wow, that's a tough one. The biggest misconception. I hate using this word pragmatic all the time. That's what I keep coming back to. I think that there are too many people raising for ideas that aren't going to work.
Yeah, 100% agree with that.
Especially
here in the UK, I would say, actually.
I don't begrudge anyone, and I mean this wholeheartedly, the idea of trying to go out and get capital to turn an idea into a business. I really don't, and I have done it, and I'm completely on board with the entrepreneur. But there's a very weird kind of friction that I've noticed ever since I've really been involved, even in raising my own stuff, between an expectation of I should be funded and the funder should pay me the attention, and likewise the funder feeling this sort of pressure to speak to lots and lots of people on the basis that there's going to be a diamond amongst the rough, when we already know statistically that whatever it is, 98 out of 100 don't raise again, or whatever the crazy numbers are. So the biggest misconception to me is that everyone that's raising should be funded, because in the sea of pitches that you see at an event every night in this city, every single night you could go to a pitch event. In New York, I was there I was in New York, and there's even more.
Yeah.
And I guess in Silicon Valley, it's, you know, turn it up again. There are too many, again, this with the greatest respect, there are too many people that don't have the skill set to do it, or their market size is not appropriate, or the path to get there is long and arduous and just not venturable, or sales cycles are 9 to 12 months or whatever it might be. They're not backable by people that manage others' money and have a 5-year investing period.
The interesting thing there, I would say, and this is why I said in the UK maybe more than elsewhere, is because I think the biggest head fake, and it's an incredible thing to have, But the biggest head fake is SEIS and EIS, because it puts people, it gives founders this sort of illusion that they have somehow raised, because they have raised capital, that somehow or the other that makes them venture backable.
Yeah. Right?
And the reality is, I mean, we've had VCs on the podcast that have said that, you know, that they won't invest in a business that has raised SEIS or EIS, because often at those early stages, like dilution, you know, has not been properly managed. But essentially, if you are building a business that has the market opportunity and potential, then a VC will back you, right? If on the other hand, you're kind of building something interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, an angel's going to back you. And an angel that backs you that is also able to get, you know, 50, 70% tax relief on their investment, whatever
the
number
is.
Well,
it's not just angels either. There's a weird...
Yes.
There are plenty of firms out there, not naming any names, but there's plenty of them that post daily with, please send me your, you know, EIS, because they need to submit by a certain time, and
because the incentives are completely different.
So I sort of agree with you. I think the EIS and SEIS has been a great game changer for tax purposes and inheritance tax especially. Mm. And I believe it's helped a lot of companies do their start, but I also take your point. There's a lot of companies that can raise under that banner that maybe
shouldn't have.
Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, this could be controversial and I've really only just thought about it, but I wonder whether the angel system and the VC, as in the professional, as opposed to the, has become too intertwined, because we always, you know, absolutely, I've, you know, done some angel investing, of course, and you want to see those companies graduate to being backed by a professional outfit, especially if there's the mythical value add. But actually, you know, there's a great subsection of these angel investments that aren't compatible over here, based on their performance and output, I guess.
And part of that is actually, part of that comes down to sort of, as an angel, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the 100x, or are you looking for a 5x, or whatever?
I mean,
right?
Most people are doing EIS, SEIS to sort their tax position out.
Yep.
And you know, after 3 years, this is the great tragedy of it. After 3 years, they
doesn't really matter.
Don't care anymore.
Yeah, I do find it. Yeah, I think there needs to be some sort of change. I don't know what that change is, and I agree with you. I mean, there are institutions out there that are certainly doing this. Some are better than others, but you know, we've worked with a number who are great.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But equally, you know, you can see it in the term sheets, right?
But outside of those things, in my opinion, there are too many accelerators and incubators that take on businesses for the sake of filling their cohort or maybe even charging them money or whatever it is, or taking and those companies aren't good enough. They're not going to get funded. Mm. And you've probably been at all the same pitch events put on by accelerators and incubators where you think, well, that one's okay. And then the rest of them, you're like, and that's, again, it's really not, it's not against a founder for trying. Go for it. But I find that too many of those end up hanging around for years. And we've all seen it, or whether it's on LinkedIn or other social, the same founder really pushing and pushing for 2-3 how many years are we talking here?
5-10 in some instances.
Still trying to get this early rare, you know, and it's become a life quest.
I've had founders that we've worked with where I've specifically said to them, okay, you should be now looking to exit, because this is not going to go kind of up and to the right. But they've been chasing the, I want to raise venture. Like, I want to tick that box off,
sure.
Right? And then, but where does that lead them? That means 10 years into the business, they may not have an exit opportunity, because at that point you've raised venture, your valuation's gone to whatever. If there isn't market appetite to acquire you at a multiple of that, then, you know, your investors...
I mean, it's a great piece of advice if you can get it from someone that says, you know, I genuinely don't think you've got a backable business.
I mean, to be honest, that's 90% of the conversations that I have, certainly.
Because, you know...
With early stage
fans. It's not always killing a dream.
Yeah. It's allowing them to actually focus on something.
You could say, do you know what? Like, yeah, this isn't going to work, but you've got a great skill set in this, that, or you've got amazing domain expertise in this, that, and the other, and you really should focus there rather than trying to reinvent, you know, this sort of wheel just because you've discovered that an AI LLM can do a load of clever stuff for you.
Mm.
And I think that's, like, right now, more than ever, is a huge kind of danger that even more early stage companies, really early stage companies, are going to get investment, whether it's through those schemes or others, on the basis of, you know, someone coming along saying, oh, I think we can do this to do that, rather than, you know, genuinely solving a problem that, you know, many, many people are going to pay for.
Yeah. I mean, I learned those lessons. So I made the decision very quickly to shut down my business once I realized that I didn't have a problem solution fit. I didn't have product market fit. I raised a couple of years before the market just sort of went down. And I knew I would have either had to have raised a lot of money to do exploration, essentially, to figure out what that product should look like. Or, you know what, actually, I'm going to, you know, clean sheet of paper, shut that down, like, with all respect to my investors. And I did it, you know, as positively as I could. Clean the business, made sure there was no liabilities, all the rest of it. And now I'm building another business, which actually I fundamentally do believe can grow and do well, but it's definitely not a business that either needs necessarily investment, but certainly doesn't need venture investment, right? I think too many founders, or a lot of founders, end up wasting is the wrong word, right? Because you learn a lot through the process, et cetera, right? But I think a lot of founders don't make that quick decision to shut down because they are worried about what that means, you know, how they will be looked at. And this is, you know, we've had this conversation on the podcast before. I think there is a fundamental problem in the UK and Europe more generally, where we really do not, you know, we don't even applaud success often, but we definitely do not applaud failure, right? Whereas in the US, I think there is, you know, obviously people are, you know, if something doesn't go well, you're going to get the usual hit pieces, et cetera. But for the most part, within the venture community, it's sort of a case of...
You can start again.
Yeah, start again, or, you know, you learned this, or, you know...
Yeah, great that you gave it a go. And faster.
And faster, right? Whereas in the UK, I think a lot of founders, you know, they're worried about what their mates will say, because we just don't have that same mentality. And I think that's the other thing that kind of plays into this, right? And if you don't have the outcome after having poured 5-6 years in, you know, maybe that's a difficult pill to swallow. Look, just as we kind of wrap up, a couple of kind of tail end questions. You may have actually already just given the answer to this, but what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home?
I mean, I think that there's a difference between positivity and optimism, but I think that my sort of, where my opinion differs to a lot of people in most situations is that that's not true, actually, not most situations, but in often situations, it might be at homework or day to day, is that I think I try and focus on the positive thing that might happen from whatever scenario we're in. So I've tried not to dwell on what can go wrong anymore or any negatives. And, you know, that might be as simple as, should we go here today? Oh, there's never any parking there. I don't care about the parking anymore. You know what I mean? I just want to go there.
Yeah.
Or it might be, let's go to that restaurant. Oh, but the kids won't eat anything there. Let's go to the restaurant. Mm. I think that, like, I've started living my life by that mantra for various reasons, but that may seem at odds with what I've said about the companies, but when I speak to the founders, I'm definitely positive in the discussion.
Mm.
But you can also be brutally realistic in the fact that, you know what, your solution, if you could get it there, would be great, but
I don't see how, with
this current setup, or with this team, or with your ability, or with your time, whatever it is, you're actually going to get there, because there's not one of us that hasn't got a brilliant idea. Star Trek transporter, best idea ever. I'm not going to raise money for it because it's physically impossible to do it.
I mean, ideas are infinite, execution is limited.
Correct. Yeah. And I think so, where I kind of wouldn't butt heads with people, but I think actually very lucky to have similar mentality in the team, is that we're always super, super positive. Mm. When we meet a founder, like, our open mind, like, I met a random founder in New York the other day in a coffee shop who had been introduced. Absolutely loved the idea. It's definitely going to go places. It's not for us right now, but it's going to work. And like, just listening to her for 30 minutes with one of my colleagues, we're both like, dude, she was awesome. Mm. Like, so like, totally open-minded, whereas other people might be like, oh, here we go again, another founder. Like, I'm not, but I would say one thing is maybe this sort of positive attitude. Sometimes people would prefer, you know, oh God, you need to be a bit more realistic or something. Well, like, in day-to-day, I'd rather be positive in the investing thing. I'd be positive and then realistic after. I guess that's it.
I think the positive thing. So the way I think about that, and again, I think that's a really great approach, is because I come from the kind of finance background that I come from, and I've been building businesses or running businesses for 20 years. What really became quite difficult, or not difficult, but what I notice about myself is when I was looking at angel investments, right? I was constantly looking at, okay, how's this going to fail? And I think if you're making investments at very early stage, where, you know, relatively early stages, yes, of course, there are a million and one reasons why something's going to fail. You've got to figure out what are the reasons why it can work. And if you can get to that conviction that it can work, great. Right. And that's not to say you should find reasons.
The fastest way to get back to that conviction, in my opinion, is back to the person again.
The founder. Yeah.
Like, there are some founders out there, I, you know, might disagree with how they think they're going to get to the big exit, but they're going to do it.
Yeah.
Just know something's going to happen. They're going to make something happen. Mm. Right. And I think that's the same with all mercurial people. Mm. It doesn't matter. I mean, I think sometimes we can all be guilty in this industry of walking around thinking everyone's in a startup and founder world. Of course, there's not. There's millions and millions of people doing similar things in other walks of life, but mercurial talent and that kind of unknown about people, the thing you can't put your finger on, you just know they're going to make something happen one way or another.
Yeah. And one final question, so we can get to know the real you, although I think we've probably made some good inroads there anyway. Mm. What is something that moves you the most emotionally?
I've always been like a fan of the underdog. Well, that's not necessarily the underdog, the downtrodden. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer that every human being deserves the same amount of respect, depending on how they behave, of course. But so I get sort of moved emotionally by sort of unfair situations. I've worked in Rwanda and India and places where the wealth and socioeconomic disparity is huge. And I've also had those moments where you see the true character of a human being by how they treat others. I think that emotionally probably moves me the most, how you treat other people. And, you know, it doesn't, I know this is a sort of old school phrase, but, you know, manners cost nothing. Treating people well doesn't cost anything. Mm. And that stuff winds me up. If I see people being sort of misfairly treated or, you know, looked down upon or, even the kind of David Goliath stuff kind of gets my back up for sure, which is why, you know, I do like this industry because, you know.
You can back the underdog.
And most of them are going, you know, eventually they're planning to go against someone much, much bigger than them because they're not going to take market from nowhere. They've got to take it from someone. Mm. But yeah, emotionally that sort of thing really pushes my buttons.
I think I'm exactly the same. I found myself more recently when I watch various films or series or whatever, and I see those sort of almost overly dramatized, but for effect, you know, those kind of the I think the power control kind of dynamic, right, where it's being abused or misused or whatever. I just
find that, you know, human to human respect is a really, really simple thing to have. And I think people that abuse that or don't have time or respect for others, you know, they're they're not going to be friends with me.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great sentiment and a wonderful way to wrap up the podcast. So, Ollie, for the audience, where can they find you online? You're on LinkedIn, you're on Twitter. Where's the best place?
Well, sure. I mean, I do use LinkedIn. I'm Ollie Harris at Dream, so you can search for me. And that's pretty much it. I gave up Instagram and Facebook and Twitter/X about 2 months ago, with very good reason. I was actually going on holiday with my family and I thought, you know, I don't want to look at any of this stuff. And I've been a much happier person since. And so unfortunately, I don't use any of those platforms anymore, apart from if I have to do a bit of research. But yeah, LinkedIn is pretty much it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time. It's been absolutely epic.
Yeah, thanks for the time. It's been great. Nice to see you.